Welcome to Healing with Worth, a podcast dedicated to healthy recovery and instilling hope in the wake of betrayal trauma. We are women who have experienced this intimately and want to offer hope to other women. While we may interview professionals on the show, the content should not be taken as therapeutic advice and is not meant to replace therapeutic healing. If you would like to join one of our free online Worth groups to help with your betrayal trauma, you may find us at healingwithworth.org. Welcome to Healing with Worth. We are your hosts, Naomi and Janine, and today we have a special guest with us. We have been eagerly awaiting this day to interview Tony Overbay. And Tony Overbay is a licensed marriage and family therapist, a certified mindful habit coach, and a popular motivational speaker. Tony regularly speaks at corporate training events, schools, and churches in formal and casual settings, mixing humor, clinical experience, his Christian faith, and a wealth of personal stories gleaned from years of helping others achieve their goals. Tony is also the author of two different podcasts, The Virtual Couch and Waking Up to Narcissism. Those are just a couple of places you can find him.
So welcome, Tony.
I am so excited to be here. And that isn't just the cliche. I think, and I always love when people that are going to hear this don't even know that we were just talking like old friends for the last 10 minutes and we finally need to hit the record. I really am grateful to be here and you make it so comfortable. So thank you.
Thank you. We really appreciate your time. A lot of women in our audience are suffering from the residuals of their husband's porn use, and narcissism and abuse plays into that. And we really appreciate your new podcast that you're doing called Waking Up to Narcissism. For our audience members who have not tapped into that resource, I would highly recommend it. There's a particular topic that we'd like to talk to Tony today about, and that is something called trauma bonding. And hopefully Tony will help educate you more about that and what it is. So let's jump right into the many questions that we have for you, Tony.
Yeah, no, this is so good. And I want to give you full permission, of course, to get me back on track, because I do get pretty passionate about this. And I feel like sometimes we could jump right in and say, here's definition of trauma bond. But if you're okay, I almost want to take a step back and talk about attachment, if that's okay.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, because I feel like it's fascinating, because, and I guess at the core of a trauma bond is someone that maybe didn't see modeled what a healthy attachment style was. I find so often that even when I'm trying to preach to the world that you can have love or control in a relationship, not both, or how dare someone tell you how you're supposed to think, feel, or believe, I know that I say these words and I feel like everyone hears those and they know exactly what that means and looks like. But I realize that sometimes I'm painting this just utopian picture of what a relationship should look like, and that people are hearing that, okay, that's nice, but can we get back to what I'm dealing with? I'm trying to step back and really share what a healthy attachment would look like, because I feel like almost sometimes people need to understand that, first of all, they're good. I mean, they're trying their best, but we only know what we know. And a lot of times I feel like until someone goes through a situation, a traumatic situation, or they realize, okay, I can't do this anymore, that's when they go try to find the tools. I feel so often people don't have the tools, because why would they? And they're not even going to go find them until they go through things. So that's where I want to start by saying, if you are listening to this podcast or mine, then you're on that path of awakening, and then bless your heart and welcome aboard. It's probably going to take some time, and that's normal. Let's start from the womb. I think that's a good place, right? Where if we really look at what attachment looks like, is when we are born, we come right out of the gate, don't get our needs met, then we will die. I mean, that is in our core DNA and our programming. So baby will scream and cry, and then people jump and pick it up and change its diaper. And so if you think about it that way, you know, the way that we interact with the world is I express myself and then I get my needs met. And if I do that, then I'm good. I will live. I'll survive. And thankfully, babies are cute. But then when we get into like the 3, 4, 5, this is where I say, okay, now things branch out into we've got an abandonment and an attachment wound. Where this looks like is that now a kid is still saying, I need to get my needs met, but their needs might be candy before dinner or staying up past their bedtime or whatever that looks like. So they say, I would like this. And then the parent says no. And all of a sudden it's okay, but I just asked, I expressed myself. This has been working since the day I was literally born. And now I can even use words, but you're not meeting my needs. And so in comes abandonment. So what abandonment looks like is, And this is where we're going to start jumping into the narcissism. Every little kid, by definition, is a little narcissist because they are egocentric and they don't have empathy or a view of what others are going through. So now all of a sudden, if I'm being told I can't have candy before dinner, first of all, I'm not getting my needs met. I may die. And I know this sounds dramatic, but I mean, that's our programming. So how am I going to get my needs met? All of a sudden, I need to do whatever I can. I need to scream. I need to cry. I need to shut down. And then we start learning gaslighting as a childhood defense mechanism. It's programmed. And I love this fact where if you look at a good narcissist as an adult with the training as a little kid, that then if we eventually say, okay, you can have candy this one time, but this is it. We set the boundary. This is it. And a little kid, they don't even pay attention to the boundary. They just got their needs met. And then they just learned, if I gaslight and throw a fit, I'll eventually get my needs met. And so I don't know, I almost feel like, you know, cue some music because we're foreshadowing for what is going to happen in adulthood, right? And so then the abandonment piece is that, and so not having a concept of what others are going through as a little kid, that if people don't meet my needs, then it must be me. I must be broken. I must be unlovable. You know, something must be wrong with me. So then I feel like we start going through life with these two things happening. This abandonment, that if somebody isn't meeting my needs, then they think I'm bad or they think I'm broken. And if I am abandoned, then I will die. So I will do anything to get my needs met. So now we're over in that attachment. So I will gaslight. I will scream. I will yell. I will get abusive. I will withdraw. And so I feel like that really sets the stage for how we enter into adulthood and into relationships. So we feel like, okay, I must find an attachment or else I'll die. And then I will do anything to get that attachment, including I will love bomb. I will say, man, I like all those same things too. And then once, you know, I get that attachment, and sometimes that even, I know in the world of narcissism, that's the love bombing. The woman in that situation that says, it's wild. Like everything is amazing about this person. We just get along, we click on every level, and then we get married. And then all of a sudden, where did that go? And it's because, okay, I've got the attachment. I'm good. And I'm talking so much. I don't know, Naomi Jean, like thoughts on this, or you can poke holes in this, or what do you think?
Well, first I'm thinking a couple things. I'm thinking about one of my children.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, how do I stop this from him becoming a narcissist? Yeah, right. Number one. And then the other thing that popped into my head, really silly thing that popped into my head, was Frozen.
Okay.
Where he's like love bombing her, right? He's like agreeing with everything that she says. And then, you know, at the end, he's like, I don't love you. I never loved you. I just want, you know, like that's like classic love bomb narcissist example. But
no, that's so right. It's I've never broken that one down. And I have these dreams someday of breaking down all kinds of films and movies and showing, because in one sense, we're having that reinforced as well, which is, you know, not to be dramatic about it, but, you know, we see that and we think, oh, that's a great movie. You know, that's awesome. But then it is that kind of teaching this emotional immaturity in a sense. So then now let's start getting into that, the world of trauma bond. If you never saw a secure attachment modeled, if your parents didn't have this secure attachment with each other, what a secure attachment looks like to a kid is that my kid can, they may do things wrong and I'm not going to punish them for no reason, or I'm not going to, there's going to be consistency in how I show up as a parent. And so if we didn't get that model from our parents, then we don't even know that that's a thing. We don't even know that you can take ownership for something. We don't know that that we're not going to, you know, be abandoned if we say, my bad, you know, that's on me. Because if we never saw our parents do that, then we're never going to do it ourselves. And I overuse this example, but it's a real one, where I was talking with a teenage girl once whose mom showed up a couple of hours late to get her at school and no one else was around. She was so angry, the teenager was, and she gets into the car and the mom just said, in essence, you know what, don't even start with me. Like, you don't even know what my day was like. And then the teenager tried to express herself. And then she just said, that's ridiculous. Again, you don't even know what it's like to be an adult and that sort of thing. And so there was so much happening there where the mom didn't take ownership and just say, I am so sorry, I'm late, or that must be hard. And so, you know, didn't model the taking ownership or accountability, and also didn't validate her feelings and saying, that must be really difficult, and I am so sorry. And so what does that teach? Subconscious level, even, it just says, I just need to defend myself. I need to jump out early and I need to take control of this situation. And I don't admit fault. And I even make the other person feel bad. And then we don't have to deal with any of these heavy emotions. You know, when you really start looking at all the different ways that this stuff is showing up or taught, it's almost no wonder that we show up emotionally immature in a relationship. And then we're, you know, then we want so desperately this connection, because abandonment equals death. And then the attachment stuff kicks in where, and I'll do whatever it is. I'll say that, yeah, I love that stuff too. You know, that sort of thing. So then with my hands, what I'm doing is, so everyone, again, I'm all or nothing statements, but when I lay it out the way I do, so we're codependent and we're enmeshed. My hands are together right now. And I tried to lay the case out that I'm not saying that's good, bad. I'm just kind of saying it just, it is. It just, that's the way we show up in relationships. So here's where things start to get interesting, I think, is that then we start to have life experiences. And so then we may start to have different opinions or different views. So that is part of, instead of codependent and enmeshment, we start to become interdependent. And it's called differentiated. So the reason I like doing it with my hands is differentiation is where one person ends and the other begins. And this is, again, this is part where I don't think we even know that this is a possibility in a relationship, because most likely we haven't seen it modeled. And so we feel like, no, I have to be enmeshed. We have to be the same. But in reality, as we go through life and we have parenting challenges, faith challenges, health challenges, challenges in our extended family, and we start to have different opinions and we express them. But if our spouse says, that's ridiculous, you shouldn't think that, now we start to feel unsafe to really be able to express ourselves. And this is where the trauma bond starts. Because, okay, I didn't see a healthy attachment or healthy relationship modeled. I desperately want that, because if I don't, I may die. And I'm still trying to figure out, ooh, my attachment, how do I make this work so that I don't, that I'm not abandoned? I feel like a lot of the women in trauma bonded relationships start to say, okay, I got to figure out how, what's the right way to say this or to make sure that it goes well. And then that's the part, again, I don't mean to be overly dramatic, but breaks my heart, because now you can see the reason I lay all that out is there's so many things that are underneath the trauma bond that are unhealthy to begin with. And so then when, bless their heart, I call them in my groups often the pathologically kind person who is going to look for the best in everyone, then is going to say, okay, I tried to express myself and he kind of lost his mind. And, you know, that must be on me. Here comes my abandonment issue. So then it's like, okay, I blew that. I need to figure out how to express myself better, as well as starting to say, okay, I'm going to make excuses because there are some good times. Again, must be me. And so I need to tiptoe around this, but then I feel like I can't really express myself. And then to the narcissist, who I also will just call, we'll call emotionally immature, then they feel like, well, things are fine because we're not having arguments. We're not talking. Or when she does express an opinion, I can let her know that that's kind of silly. That's kind of ridiculous. You've never said that before. And that's the part where we grow, we develop, and we mature, because we start to have new and different experiences. And so the part of the relationship that I feel like I'm trying to sell people on almost, that I don't even know if we fully understand, is that what I think an actual healthy relationship is it's, we absolutely come together enmeshed and codependent because of these attachment and abandonment wounds. But then the whole reason I think that we get married, it's not just to replenish the earth, but I think we can't become our best self if we are just in our own head. So if we can then start to become emotionally mature and become differentiated and become interdependent, then we're two autonomous, interdependent people with all of our own experiences. And now we're both experiencing things together, and we're looking at those things with curiosity. And instead of me saying, I can't believe you think that, I say, hey, what do you think about that? And that's the way we really grow. Because if we're just looking for people to just continually tell us we're the best and we're okay, AKA narcissism, we're not going to take in any information that goes against what we think, because that would mean we're wrong. And this is where I go back to that. If we're wrong, then we might be abandoned, and abandonment equals death. So I better gaslight you to make sure that you know that I'm right. And I want you, Naomi and Jenny, tell me, because this is the stuff where I feel like, oh my gosh, that makes so much sense. But then feel like sometimes people will say, those words sound amazing and you look pretty passionate about it, but I lost you. So I don't know. Tell me if that makes sense.
Well, I appreciate the background, actually. I think it helps give context to what's going on. Pornography, from what I understand, stunts the Absolutely. Emotional maturity yeah. of a person. There's additional struggles.
Yeah.
You've got one person that's been stunted. Maybe he's been stuck yeah. in an 8-year-old, you know, maturity. And you've got this, we'll say woman mm-hmm. in our case, you know, who maybe not be fully emotionally mature, but she's certainly more emotionally mature than this person who's been yeah. viewing pornography. And that can be a very complex situation to kind of unravel.
It really can. And I appreciate you bringing that into it as well. Cause meanwhile, I love doing the couples work and I work a lot with betrayal trauma, but that all started by working with people that were, struggling with pornography addiction or turning to pornography as a coping mechanism. And that was really what I started. I've got a book called He's a Porn Addict Now What, an expert and a former addict to answer your questions. That I'm really proud of because it addresses the pornography addict and the betrayed. When I was doing that book tour, I think at the time I talked about working with about 1500 men in one-on-one and trying to help them recover from pornography addiction. And so, and the reason I'm setting that whole, it sounds like I was trying to sell my book. I'm the world's worst salesman. So I really wasn't, but in that, what I talk about often is that I feel like shame is one of the biggest components of turning to pornography as an unhealthy coping mechanism. And so when I'm working with a guy who's struggling with porn, my first goal is to get shame out of their recovery. And so now introduce that into the relationship. And if that person is so steeped in shame, because shame is not just that they're doing something bad, but they're a horrible person and they're emotionally immature. This is where, so let's go into again, a little bit of definition of narcissism is that if you really boil down almost by definition, that it's this series of unhealthy coping mechanisms that start from severe childhood neglect or abandonment or those sort of things. So where the person doesn't really have a sense of self and they require external validation to make them feel good about themselves, and which then leads to them having less empathy. And so you put that combination together with shame, and then anytime that they feel bad about themselves, then that makes them feel uncomfortable. And this is where that external validation comes in. So if in the world of external validation, this one's wild if you really think about it and how often we do this. Let me take a quick side note on external validation, because let me give an easy example and then we'll kind of work back into that one. I talk often on my podcast about I'm an ultra runner and I've done 100 and something ultra marathons. But a few years ago, I hurt my meniscus. And so I need to even stop saying I am in my intro because it's been a couple of years. I hurt my meniscus and I put on some weight. There's a whole story behind there. I became the guy that's sitting in the doctor's office saying, I used to be a runner. And I think he's looking at me going, oh, sure you were. But then I've started to increase my times a little bit. And there was a time where I came home one night from work and I was really, I don't know, I just felt a little bit emotionally overwhelmed and I didn't want to listen to a podcast. I didn't want to listen to music and I just ran. And it wasn't a cool Disney moment where I just felt at one with the streets and kind of running angry. But I looked at the end and my time was pretty good. It was probably the best time since I had hurt myself a couple of years ago. So I come inside and I know my wife's going to say, how was your run? And I don't know why I was hit with this epiphany of what internal validation versus external validation looks like, because I was really happy with my time. I thought, man, I didn't know that I would get back to a place where I could achieve this speed. It's not like I'm ready for the Olympics, but it was better than it had been in a long time. And I felt like, man, I'm going to walk in there and my wife's going to say, how was your run? Because it was like a few seconds faster, but it was faster. So I was really pleased with that. But if I was banking on someone else to make me feel better about that run, then there were so many things that she could have said that would have not been the right thing. Because if she would have said, well, how much faster, then I probably would have felt like, well, it's just a few seconds. I guess it's not a big deal. Or if she would have just said, oh, that's nice. If I would have said, it's the fastest time in a couple of years, then I would have thought, nice. It was amazing. You must not care about me. But I realized, oh, I feel good about that time. So now I'm going to go in and being internally validated. Now, any conversation we're going to have is from curiosity and it's connection. So if she says, well, how much faster, then I'm now saying like 3 seconds, but I'm pumped. And it's not like, what do you think? And now we're looking at this as two different autonomous people that are sharing an experience and looking at that with curiosity. And that is where growth occurs. I just give that example because now I'll jump back into if someone feels shame and they don't like that and they can't just kind of say, okay, I need to accept that I turn to porn as a coping mechanism. I need to accept the fact that what am I pretending not to know, that when I'm alone, my trigger is, I call them crimes of opportunity, or it's boredom, or it's not because this person did this, or these people said this. So that takes a lot of work for the pornography addict to get to that place of acceptance and get rid of that shame. If they're stunted in that emotional immaturity and they feel really bad about themselves, and now they've grown up needing external validation, then they need someone else to make them feel better. And the way to do that is to put it on somebody else. And this is where that narcissism happens. If I can put myself in a one-up position, then I will feel better for that moment. And that's the part that I think can be so difficult. Boy, look at all these variables, right? You got abandonment, you got attachment. We're naturally going to be enmeshed and codependent. And the reason, again, I lay all that out is bless anyone's heart that's listening to this. you're not doing anything wrong. You're just doing, you're just being. And so now that you become aware, now it's, what do I do with that? And so that starts to become a place of strength. The thing about trauma bonds that's hard is that even as you start to become aware of this, as you start to pull away or find yourself or speak your voice, now you're threatening that bond with the emotionally immature or narcissist. So this is now where they will now know all of the buttons to push to then get you to feel bad so that you come back, because they're the ones that are now scared or afraid. And instead of a little 8-year-old throwing a fit, it's a grown man, and they can say really mean things and do physical things and withhold things. And that's the stuff, again, breaks my heart. I often have women in the group or that email me that even say, okay, I'm aware. And this is why I even called the podcast Waking Up to Narcissism, because it's a waking up process and it isn't an immediate thing. And I talk often on my podcast, I don't know how you feel about this, because I realize that people read about narcissism, and then my joke is it always says, don't finish the paragraph, just leave. Right. And right. And then I'm like, okay, but no one can do that. So then I was going to be the narcissist whisperer is what I was going to be. And so then, and I felt, well, and even the waking up to narcissism, and I'm really open on my podcast about this, is I'm waking up to my own narcissistic traits and tendencies. And when you frame that from an emotional immaturity, it's empowering. And I'm starting to get more men that are starting to say, oh my gosh, that's me. And a lot of the women that are saying, oh man, I thought I was crazy. But the stories that I tell on that podcast, just the emails I get that people just say, I felt like you were in my house, or I felt like you were in the car with us during the argument. So then the narcissist, the emotionally immature, knows how to push your buttons to then get you to then come back. And so now the trauma bond is typically between the extreme emotional immature or narcissist with these deep abandonment wounds and shame that needs external validation to feel better, but doesn't even know the tools to take ownership or acceptance of what their experience is. They have to put it on you, and you are the nicest person in the world who is trying to figure out how to make this thing work. I feel like that's the part where it's just such a process. And then when people say, so on my podcast, I lay out these 5 rules of narcissism, and they came from a place of saying, okay, no, I hear you. If you want to figure this out, then the first thing is raise your emotional baseline. Let's get some self-care going. Self-care is not selfish. As I lay these out, you'll almost hear the narcissist in your brain saying, but you're being selfish. You are neglecting this or doing this or whatever. And it's another way to keep somebody in that trauma bond, is by keeping them down in that one down position. So it's raise your emotional baseline, self-care. The second thing I always say is get your PhD in gaslighting. It's interesting. I'm sure that you guys and the work that you do, I'm almost surprised that when somebody says, I'm not familiar with that term, because I mean, we work in it daily, right? And but it's like, man, that is a liberating thing to realize that gaslighting is a real thing and that I'm not crazy.
As a young woman, I didn't even know I had a PhD in gaslighting.
I know.
Yeah.
Right?
Who knew?
Even adult women, once they come into this situation, they're like, gaslighting, what is that? And so until they understand what it is, then they're like, oh, yeah. It's so enlightening, because it puts vocabulary to what they've been experiencing. At least it did for me.
No, absolutely. I mean, it does. And you know what's interesting though? And boy, my working with narcissism brain just kicks in here. And women even hearing this, I feel like sometimes they may say, oh, I'm going to let him know that I now know he's gaslighting me. The person doesn't go, oh my gosh, thank you, I wasn't even aware of this. And I tell this, it's such a true story. I did a gaslighting episode on the virtual couch years ago, and I had 2 women in particular I was working with, and they both, and it was within hours, texted me and said, hey, so I shared that episode with my husband and said, hey, you're doing this. This might be helpful to know. And both of them wrote back and said, actually, I listened to it and you do this. And then they're like, oh, so do I? So they got gaslit about gaslighting, which is crazy.
It happens all the time. Yeah.
And it's super common.
It is, right? It does. Yeah. And I call that one a little bit too, of the narcissist that's parroting. So, you know, if you say you hurt my feeling, well, you hurt my feeling. I think you gaslight. Well, yeah, you gaslight me. The kind person is sharing, this is important to me or this hurts me. Then to the narcissist, they say, oh, thank you for that button I can push. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And hand them over, which I guess kind of plays into, so my third rule after, so the self-care, raise your baseline, get your PhD in gaslighting. It really is to get yourself out of unproductive conversations, because once you know the gaslighting, then we know this isn't going anywhere, which leads to the fourth one, which is kind of hard, which is set healthy boundaries. And then knowing that there's a little asterisk behind that that says, and just know for a fact that a boundary is a challenge for the narcissist, but doesn't mean we don't try to set them, but just know that, okay, this is still for my sanity. And then the fifth thing that's really difficult, I think at first, but then I think becomes empowering is I say, realize that there's nothing you'll say or do that will cause that person to have the aha moment or the epiphany. That's going to have to come from them. And that's the part where I feel like the harder someone in a trauma bond tries to explain themselves that, no, you're wrong, or this is what I meant, or do you know that you did this? Again, they're just saying, here's another button. You know, here's more things to use when you get angry with me. And now I think we've got all the ingredients for a trauma bond. Abandonment, attachment, you know, I've handed over my weapons, I've handed over my buttons so they can weaponize. And so now it's just this absolute, just a consistent pattern, the cyclical pattern. And so it's created by this just whole cycle of abuse and then positive reinforcement. Because then after the abuse, then the abuser professes love and then regret. And then they are going to, no, I get it now. And so knowing that we desperately want that secure attachment. So then when they say the right thing, then we say, okay, this is good. This time it's different. And I've worked with hundreds of couples that struggle with this. Again, breaks my heart. I overuse. But when the wife will then say, no, it really has been a good week. I mean, things got a little off, but then he said, no, I can understand. And things are gonna be different. And so lately I've been saying a lot of, when somebody says it's good, that I say, okay, is it good or is it an absence of bad? Is there a connection? Is there a tell me more? Is there curiosity in the relationship? And typically then you see the look of, oh no. So I guess this wasn't bad. And you deserve more than just not bad. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I will admit I have listened to your podcast a lot.
Thank you.
I binged it. So, and the reason why I really appreciate your popcorn analogy, that has been one that I have literally watched happen in my own relationship just through text messaging, because I don't respond when it's happening, but I just watch that cycle go through. The thing that I find interesting is that even though I'm not engaging, even though I'm not responding, I still get that heightened like fight, flight, or freeze. Yeah. And then when he finally cycles around back to the, I'm sorry, I'm going to try harder, I'm going to do, I'm going to do all the right things. And then that calm comes, even though I've...
Oh, interesting. Like, yeah.
Boundaries are very firm, very set, very distant. Yeah. And yet there still is...
That, I love that. I haven't thought of that.
Those feelings. Yeah. And so that's something that I've found really interesting, that I see the cycle and I watch it play out. I probably have thousands of pages of text messages in these cycles. And that's where I'm like, wow, but I still get in that state. So maybe I'm not separated enough. Maybe my boundaries aren't far enough. I don't know.
I'm going to kind of address this on the fly. I love that you're bringing that up. And I don't know, for your listeners, the popcorn moments is literally once you do all these things and you're disengaged and you sit back. And I did have a story of someone that they honestly had movie theater popcorn on their counter, and the person was then going into all the gaslighting and they didn't respond at all. So they sat back and ate popcorn and watched the show. And the first act was anger. Like, how dare you say that about me? And they didn't say anything. And then the person said, okay, that didn't work. You know, the narcissist is like, that didn't work. So then the next act was sadness. I mean, it was like, oh my gosh, what is wrong with me? Like, I can't even believe I'm doing this right now. And the person said, then I got another bite of popcorn, and act three was humor. It was the comedy. You know, it's like, but I'm kidding. You know, I'm messing around with you, right? And then they didn't take that one either. And then I think act four was a horror. You know, then it was like, they were so intense. And then the show ended and the person left with their, I call them narcissistic exits. I mean, I've had people, they feign heart attacks, or they have a pain in a joint, or they just get emotionally flooded, or they're going to faint, or anything to then take ownership of the moment. So Naomi, what I think is interesting is, are you guys pretty familiar with, it's the book, The Body Keeps the Score?
Yes.
Bessel van der Kolk?
Yes.
That one is amazing. Back in my narcissistic days, I would tell you, I've done thousands of hours of research on what I'm about to tell you. But no, I'm going to shoot from the hip and put a few things together. But I really feel like in the world of couples counseling, I'm a big fan of what's called emotionally focused therapy, EFT. And there's a book called EFT for Dummies that has a really easy chapter that talks about that our emotions, and neurologists confirm that our emotions travel about 2.5 times faster than our logic or our thinking. And that is what we call our visceral reaction. And The Body Keeps the Score talks about that, where that is a protection. I mean, that's a miracle. That's like, that's a God. I mean, that's like, you walk out the door and you see a string on the ground and you kind of recoil and then you realize, oh, it's not a snake. I mean, think of that, and your emotions are ahead of your logic. It's there for our protection. So unfortunately, the emotions are firing 2.5 times faster than thinking or logic. And so your emotions, instead of us feeling like I need to not think something, we need to realize, oh, I thought that. Now take a look at that. So what I like about that, Naomi, is you can sit there, watch the show, and it's almost like, oh, he just said the right thing. And your emotion fires before logic. And the emotion is like, oh, yeah, that's the thing I want. You know, and then I feel like then the logic goes, wait a minute, I've seen this one before. So I feel like that's a really healthy response. Sometimes I think what happens with the body is it will just kind of go flat, you know, and then there's that complete apathy or no emotion. Man, one of the things that again is really empowering, I think, for women that are starting to wake up to narcissism or understand trauma bond is to then get back to trusting their gut. At the core, anxiety is there to protect us. It's just that then we sometimes, it can get the best of us. And I will have women that will try to continue to go back into an unhealthy narcissistic relationship. And they do, their heart rate elevates, they have panic attacks, they can't eat, they want to throw up. And they're like, okay, but now that I have this new information, I can go back in. And their body is saying, I don't know how else to get your attention. You're right, I'm going to raise your blood pressure, I'm going to make you throw up, I'm going to do whatever, because you're not paying attention to me. And that's sometimes, that's what I think is what ultimately helps people say, okay, enough is enough. And on one of the group calls on my private women's Facebook group is a woman was talking about, she's been out of a narcissistic relationship for about 10 months. And now she's off of her blood pressure medication, which she's been taking for 30 years. And she just said, I thought that was genetic or chronic. And it was narcissistic is what it was. So yeah, right.
It's incredible. Yeah. And it's interesting because I think this trauma bond, I think, is so hard to recognize. And then, like you were saying, even when you recognize it, it's not an automatic switch. And I think that's something that I noticed just from some of the women that I've been in contact with and that I've been involved with and just seen. And as an outside person, you want to like,
yeah,
here, you can do this. Just like the narcissist has to come to their own understanding, so does the person who's trauma bonded have to kind of find their way and
they do. And take those. And honestly, that's where I was about to say, I apologize for going so geeky at the first, but I think it's just so important to recognize. I feel like what I'm trying to put together the last few months is, especially with the feedback I get from the Waking Up the Narcissism podcast, is again, it's hitting me that people don't even know what the goal is. If people don't know that healthy relationships are not about control, I mean, I often say you can have love or control, not both, in an adult relationship, that then they feel like, no, this, I guess this is how relationships are. And the trauma bond consists of a lot of things, you know, even people that will say, well, at least he doesn't hit me, or, you know, I do have a roof over my head, or those kind of things. And that isn't a healthy relationship. But then people feel just scared or stuck or that sort of thing. So this is such a process. And that's where I love when people email me and say they finally feel heard or understood. But I realize that I'm just some guy talking over a microphone. And so I feel like when you can put people in touch with, and that's this group that I have, the power of women that are in it or have been through it and communicating with each other, I feel like there's another level of, maybe it's the body keeps the score of where there's a visceral reaction of more trust by somebody that speaks the same language or has been through it. I've done a couple episodes on how difficult it can be when you do open up to somebody about it. And if you find what they call Switzerland friends, Switzerland sounds super cool other than this scenario where it's somebody that's saying, well, there's two sides, you know, or the most downloaded episode I've done is one called Death by 1,000 Cuts, which is just, you know, it's like just all these little things. If you tell somebody he does this and this, and they just say, and, but take that over 20, 30 years.
Yeah.
It's so hard. Yeah.
That's the, what they say.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes.
All relationships are like this. All relationships have a piece of this.
You're so right. Cause that is where people are saying, well, yeah, but everybody does that. Everybody gets mad. Everybody does. And honestly, maybe I'm fooling myself, but I'm literally a marriage therapist, and you don't have to shout and yell to be heard. If you have to shout and yell to be heard, boy, talk about trauma bonds, where I can think of so many people, so many women that I've worked with that say, yeah, but I do yell at him. And then I say, okay, when you got into the relationship, did you just go out and start yelling at people? Or is that what you eventually started doing in response to the gaslighting? Because it's our body keeps a score. If we don't feel like we can be heard or understood, we're going to try somehow. And it's going to be that visceral reaction, that emotions before logic. And so that's even further evidence that this isn't good. This isn't healthy.
Yeah. That crazy making.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I love what you said about the women in their group, because in our program in Worth, that is one of the biggest pillars that we have is connection with other women who have similar experiences, at least for myself. And maybe Janine, you can speak to it as well, but we have group therapies, and that has been one of the biggest helps for my own recovery, was being in a group of other women with a therapist who could give vocabulary to what we were experiencing and really help to see it clearer than we had before. And I think that's empowering because, you know, you get so many women in the situation and you can't always think, because of that trauma that you're in, you can't always think of questions right in the moment. When you have a group of women that have their own questions, then everybody's like, oh yeah, oh, I totally needed that, but I didn't know I needed that. And so you create this mode of therapy that is really helpful, because you're getting things that you didn't realize that you had questions, but that you're like, oh yeah, that makes sense. I have experienced that too, but I didn't know that's what it was that I was experiencing.
I love that, because it is that we don't know what we don't know in those aha moments. But then I feel like, boy, just wanting to tell people, if they're listening, is that so often we'll have an aha moment. It'll give us a nice little dopamine bump. Then we think, okay, but then body keeps the score. We're back in our similar environment. And that's why it just takes time. It's funny because in this group, people will sometimes say, is it okay if I post a link to another podcast or another YouTube video? And I think, of course. I mean, there's no scarcity of help. You need as many books and as many podcasts. And I think that is so part of the process of waking up to narcissism or escaping a trauma bond, is just that it takes time. I was going to clichedly say, takes as long as it takes, and you're doing it the best way that you can. And you give yourself grace and credit, because I feel like it's such a emotional roller coaster of feeling like, no, I can't take this anymore. And then all of a sudden, okay, well, it's not bad, or okay, but it's scary, or all those things are so normal. So I love what you're saying. And I'm curious, I mean, in your group, were there people even almost then comparing, well, mine wasn't as bad, or my situation wasn't as bad? Do you run into that?
Oh, yeah, that happens often. And that's often something that where you're like, well, everybody has a different baseline, I guess, of what they can handle, you know? So somebody may think, well, my husband didn't have an actual physical affair.
Right.
So it's not as bad as your husband who is seeking out prostitutes. There's a general understanding, like, our situations aren't exactly the same, but they are all traumatic.
Okay.
It is all trauma, and we can't compare somebody's situation to our own, because we each are having our own experience, and it is traumatic for each person.
Yeah. Oh, I appreciate that. Honestly, I kind of felt like I've made a shift a few months ago when I start talking about emotional immaturity. And I'm thinking specifically of someone had sent me a question just a few days ago. I was able to jump on and answer real quick, but they just said, but wait, couldn't we have both been narcissists? And then he was just a worse narcissist. And I said, okay, out of context, what if I would just say, well, we both enter a relationship emotionally immature. And then as we mature, then one person is willing to then start to look at things with curiosity and be able to have mature conversations. And that's where I often say, as much as you read the stuff that says run immediately, I know it's not that easy, because I feel like there is a version that there's almost like this period where you want to discover, okay, is it just we don't know what we don't know, or is someone incapable of that curiosity and empathy and being able to look outside of oneself? And so I feel like that is a process that people have to go through, in essence, almost to rule out, okay, is this as bad as I'm reading or thinking? And I think that's where people want to do that hierarchical thinking. Well, it's not as bad as this, but it is worse than this. Mm-hmm. So I love what you're saying about, what if we just start with, it's not good. I mean, it's trauma. Yeah. But if people think, well, but a little trauma is normal, then that's where I want to step in and pull my expert card and say, not really. It really doesn't need to be.
Yeah.
It is a process. It is very complicated how pornography affects the marriage and relationship. To kind of unravel from that is just so complicated.
Yeah, I like that you just got back to the pornography piece. I know I keep going away from that. I've been doing this long enough that it's finally enough data is caught up that says, turns out pornography is bad. You know, it used to only be the, you know, the it also used to, It's not really been, like, religion. I mean, it was only religious counselors. It was only religious people. And I got to tell you, a couple times, I almost feel like set up. I did a national radio show one time, and the guy wanted me to come on and talk about it. And he's like, he gets me on. He's a porn expert. And then he said, Tony, my wife and I look at porn all the time. And I was supposed to be rattled. And I said, well, then you won't need my services. You know, good for you. That sounds good. And then, but by the end of it, I was able to say, okay, but I feel like you're turning to pixels instead of people.
Right, right.
But I was able to say, okay, if that is your relationship, that you feel like that is something I need, then what is it that you are missing? You're afraid to show up. You're afraid to be known. You're afraid to be vulnerable. So that's the part where I feel like, yeah, finally we have all the data we need that says it does warp one's sexuality. And I'm not trying to throw shame in there, as I said earlier, I mean, because people typically, just like narcissism comes from deep childhood wounding, typically porn addiction comes from early exposure where people then have become sexualized. So it's that Dieter Uchtdorf talk of where their plane started heading a couple of degrees off early on, and now they're in a completely different place and are kind of looking at that like, but this is what you do, because they don't even know what the other place looks like. And that takes a lot of introspection and emotional maturity to kind of say, oh, I might be wrong. And so I know that's hard too.
And I think also there's a level of hope that women have, especially women in the gospel. You know, they didn't go into this expecting to have these abusive,
things
take place in their marriage. There's almost this eternal hope, which can also be really hard to overcome as well when you're in a situation that just isn't getting better, that just isn't changing. Then you have to really ask yourself some really hard questions.
That's so hard. And one of the areas, and I've done a bunch of podcasts on this, is I love, one of the things I really enjoy is helping people with faith journeys, faith crisis. And I've done podcasts where I talk about these stages of faith. And I love that work. What can be difficult, and I love that you brought that up, because sometimes, bless our heart, even in the religious world, where we have the world's greatest, what's called experiential avoidance opportunity. You know what? Worst case, it'll be better in the next life. And I feel like, oh man, it's so frustrating to be a therapist working in that where, okay, there's plenty of times we're going to kick the can down the road. It'll be better when summer hits, or it'll be better when the kids are out of school. But when it's it'll be better in the next life, then I feel like, oh man, there's way too much life to be lived where you're not letting your light so shine that others around you will also be edified. So those are those things I think are, again, break my heart when I see that in my office.
It is certainly something that we see a lot of. These men aren't all bad, right?
No.
Like, they're not completely horrible people. And that's kind of that struggle that you have to work with and work to overcome, because you're like, well, they're not entirely terrible. And so you've got that like rationalizing and
Can I tell you, I go so big in I've got a marriage course, and I do these episodes where I talk about what I call my four pillars of a connected conversation. And I think these are, again, I'm going to step into my healthy ego, hopefully not my narcissism, and say, I feel like these are so powerful, because this is where I've worked with, I was talking about hundreds of couples with the narcissist component, but about 1,200 or 1,300 couples as a couples therapist. And we need a framework to even be able to communicate. And when you're saying, yeah, they're not all bad, I agree. I have these four pillars that I say are absolutely necessary to have healthy conversations. And that first pillar is to assume good intentions, that nobody wakes up in the morning and thinks, how can I hurt my spouse? Now, with betrayal trauma and with emotional abuse, gaslighting, narcissism, I've added a second part to that, or there's a reason why somebody does what they do. Because I think that's what we can start getting into, if they were sexualized young, if they were abused young, that they don't even know how to communicate. They are emotionally immature. Then that second pillar is, I can't just tell someone that's ridiculous or I don't believe them, even if I think that what they're doing is ridiculous and I don't believe them. And my third pillar is ask questions before comments. And then my fourth one is to stay present, to don't go in your bunker. And we could go into that maybe in a future episode, or I encourage people to go find my four pillars. The reason why I say those is that if my narcissist is telling me I'm crazy and ridiculous and that sort of thing, if I jump into pillar one and just say, okay, there's a reason why this, he doesn't even know how to express himself emotionally in an emotional mature way. If I start with, he's really trying to hurt me, the conversation will kind of be done there. The second pillar is, even if I'm saying the gaslighting, if he's saying, you never do this, and I know that literally, like, I always do that. As soon as I say that, now we get to argue about that you never hear me, that sort of thing. So the second pillar is like, right?
Oh boy, I got a lot of work to do.
but it's so hard, because like the narcissist is trying to get you off into what I say the weeds, because then there's never going to be accountability. So, okay, I assume good intentions. I don't say he's wrong, or I don't believe you, even though I don't believe him. And then the third pillar is questions for comments. Hey, tell me more. Tell me why you feel like I'm a complete lunatic. You know, help me see my blind spots. Because a lot of times if you get to that pillar three and say, hey, that, tell me about that, I almost feel like you watch that emotional immaturity and the narcissist say, wait a minute, usually we're arguing by now. I really don't have any data to back this up. If I can get you to argue with me, I'm never going to have to feel uncomfortable. This feels uncomfortable. So I don't like this. And then pillar four is the stay present. And I hate the word, I really don't like using the word victim. But if I lay out the four pillars, I'll often say that it's really difficult, especially betrayal trauma, pillar one and two, assume good intentions and not to say you're wrong. Because it's like, but they are, because that's the gaslighting. And a lot of times pillar four guys are really bad about that. So if I can get them to, okay, their wife's going to say, look, you aren't treating me well, or you're not there for me. And if I can get them to assume good intentions, not say she's wrong, and then go into pillar three and say, okay, tell me more about that. Help me see my blind spots. Then pillar four, when I use the word victim, as a lot of guys, then we'll say, okay, I guess my opinions don't matter. I'm just a paycheck, you know, because they want now the wife to say, no, I shouldn't have brought it up.
I literally heard that.
So these pillars are gold, but then it doesn't mean they're easy, because, you know, in that realm, I say that to be heard is the goal, not to resolve, because the resolution, especially for the pathologically kind, often the woman in the trauma bond, the resolution is where they just eventually just say, okay, this isn't worth it. And then the guy says, okay, we worked it out. Okay, you see again that I am right. But if the goal is to just be heard, you know, then we're going to start to understand that we're two different people. But that's where you'll start to see, though, even with this framework, that's where I like to say, here's where the rubber meets the road. It's either, okay, we now have this new tool. It's a matter of we didn't know what we didn't know about how to communicate, or the narcissist cannot use this tool because it makes them accountable and it exposes these uncomfortable emotions. And that's where in my office doing this couples work, I shut down anything other than we focus on these four pillars. If you don't have a framework to communicate, then how on earth are you going to communicate? It's going to go right to the gaslighting and that sort of thing. That's where I really feel like you start to see, is it a viable relationship or not? And that can be really hard.
And I think I've heard you say this before, in that situation, that's where a narcissist or somebody with emotional immaturity or narcissistic tendencies or traits will usually back out of the therapy.
Oh, that one? Yeah, it's crazy. Because then all of a sudden the therapist doesn't know what they're talking about and it's crazy or whatever. Or I had a guy on my podcast a little while ago, and it's an intern of mine and he's awesome. His name's Nate. And he did all this. He loves research. We did a whole episode on the neurology of narcissism. And so he found a really cool study that was talking about, there's this almost internal external switch in the brain. It's called the default mode network. And so they find that with real narcissism, they feel like that switch is almost stuck. It's on internal, so they can't look outside of themselves. And so that one was an aha moment to me. So if I'm laying out my four pillars, and yeah, emotional maturity is the person's going to still get anxious and say, okay, but let me just tell you this or whatever. But a true narcissist, when you hear what their wife is doing, even you, Mr. Therapist, who has millions of downloads on your podcast, you claim these four pillars work, then you will realize how special I am. And you will now join me as we tell my wife that they need to do something different. I mean, it really is to that point of where that's how special the narcissist is. And so then if I don't agree with them, then it's like, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. Because I obviously do, says the narcissist. So I got to find another one who will agree with me.
Yeah.
Man, as a therapist, and this is like, bless therapist's heart, one of the hardest things to do is, a lot of times, eventually the narcissist will find a pretty new therapist who says, no, this guy sounds kind of cool. Makes sense. That is so hard. And I think that's a whole other topic for a day of
trauma therapy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's really difficult. That is.
So just a quick question here.
Yeah.
Is it safe for a narcissist to listen to your podcast?
So it's interesting. Honestly, Janine, it's one of the greatest questions, because talking about this sometimes, a real good narcissist is learning the tools and they're going to learn all the things and say the things the right way. And that's where I feel like, is that a good thing or is it not? Is the person just learning the lingo to then use it against the person? Or, because I literally had a guy recently that I hadn't seen for a while. And I at one point thought, okay, this guy's pretty narcissistic. And so we were talking about the four pillars and he was looking at him as a checkbox. And I say consistently, okay, if the narcissist is saying, no, tell me what you need me to do. First of all, they're like, okay, I did those things. Now, are we good? Versus if they really don't know, right? Or if they really don't know, then it is a tell me what to do so that I can learn. And I feel like, so that's hard. That was a big old long way to say, I have examples. I mean, part of me just wants to go ahead and read one. I mean, I get these a lot. I get them almost daily. And here's one that I think is here's the kind of stuff that I'm getting that I think is so fascinating. This is from a guy. And it just says, help, please. And he says, I was recently forwarded your podcast, The Virtual Couch. Fell in love with it on the first episode. That led me to checking out Waking Up to Narcissism. I chose it because I have parents and an ex who are somewhat on the narcissistic spectrum. And he said, this can help. And this is the stuff that I think this is wild. He said, well, it did, but not in the way I thought or wanted. I realized very quickly that these traits I was hearing are all things that I do. And then he said, so here I am worried about how the narcissist in my life are affecting it. And I realized the bigger issue is me. So then he said, do you have specific episodes dealing with how to start being more empathetic and how to kick these narcissistic habits? So I'm getting more of those. And that's the part where I try to be as open as I can. It's so funny. Even while we're talking in this podcast, I got two more that came in. They're constant because people either feel heard or the people are saying, oh man, I think I do those things. Now, what do I do? I appreciate that. But the reason I made that such a long story is to the person in the trauma bond, I worry that I read that and then they say, see, there's hope. And so I need to stick in here forever because someday my husband may say the same thing. Yeah. I know that's hard. It is. So that was a big roundabout way of saying
that eternal hope.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Maybe.
Yeah. Yeah.
Depends on the situation and the spectrum.
Yeah. It really does. Yeah. So that's where I just feel like it's all such a process. It really is.
And I just think sometimes like I have been one of those people, the eternal hope people. And I've had to come to this point where I say, you know, maybe he will eventually figure it out. And I hope he does. And I don't have to stick around to wait for him to do it.
No, you don't. You really don't. It's not your job, right? Yeah. Yeah.
Anybody who's listening and feels that way, just know that he might, and you can still be happy even if he does.
Absolutely.
Or even if he doesn't.
Yeah. No, that's perfect.
Yeah.
I'm so grateful to be able to talk about you guys. Thanks for giving me the space to lay that all out, because if anything, I want people to just know that they're okay. And that we do not have the tools. None of us do until we have to go find them. And so I know it's hard when you then have to go through things to find the tools. I don't know. It's part of this process. And so give yourself time, give yourself grace. And I feel like the more podcasts you can devour and groups you can go to and things, and then even then you're going to have all the yeah buts in your head. Well, yeah, but it's not that bad. And what a process it really is. And eventually where like you guys are and you feel hopefully more hope and alive and then spread the word. And I feel like we can't spread the word enough about emotional immaturity and what a relationship should and could look like. And so I just feel like the more people that are going through this, the better.
Thank you so much, Tony, for joining us. We know our time's up.
No, this is good.
We just really appreciate you helping to enlighten our audience a little bit more about trauma bonding and attachment and helping them to see maybe some of the patterns that exist in their own relationship that need to change.
Yeah, what a pleasure.
Thanks for joining us this week on Healing with Worth. Make sure to visit our website, healingwithworth.org, if you would like to enroll in an online therapist-led support group. We'll see you next time.